Evening is taken from the next chapter that Joe read from. We're looking at 1 Corinthians 10, verses 1 through 13. So that'll be our context, but let's go back into chapter 9 and what was just read. As you know, the book of Corinthians is not as encouraging as the book of Philippians, which was ready. Written to a church that really had its act together. Corinth was just the opposite. It seems they took their Christianity very lightly. And this is part of what Paul is saying, and it brings us up to a poignant lesson for us nowadays. He reminds of the Corinthians of the games of the time. And he says, when people get out and run a race, there's two things about it. One, they really put their heart and soul into it for a prize that's just a wreath that perishes. But for them, that's everything. That's the prize above all other prizes. And if you knew what some of the games were like, sometimes they could get kind of brutal when they were between two combatants. He says about the race is you don't run without a goal. I mean, most of the races we see, whether it's horses or people or whatever, there's usually a finish line, and everybody stays on the track and runs toward the finish line. Rarely do you see someone jump the fence and go tooling off into the field, and you go, what's that idiot doing? And Paul says, think of your Christianity the same way. How much effort do you put into it? Are you focused on the finish? He uses another analogy here, that of boxing. A lot of times, if a person doesn't have an opponent, he just sits there and kind of has an imaginary friend that he boxes with. But even then, he has to see the opponent. He has to picture it in his eyes. He has to have something that he can focus on to orchestrate what he's really doing for effect. So he has to have aim in the boxing, too. He just doesn't beat the air. He sees an opponent and goes for it. And then everything he throws, he has to throw everything into it. I mean, if you've ever been in a kind of a competition, you really don't want it to drag into 15 rounds. If you can, you want to get it done in the first round, because after that, it's all labor. And so he doesn't box without aim. Now, he says also, as you think of this, he says, now, I'm his apostle, and I do it so that after I've preached to others, I myself will not be shipwrecked or cast away, depending on your translation. Now, here's an apostle. I mean, nobody is phenomenal as Paul is in his devotion to God, except perhaps the Lord himself. And Paul is worried about, after all his labors, that he might find himself unworthy of what God has talked about, of failing at the last. And so what he's trying to get across, not only to the Corinthians, but also with chapter 10, he brings it into us also. Now he starts with what is known as a litotes, and Paul loves litotes. In fact, he brings up another one in 5. And it's saying the opposite, kind of lightly, but really implying a very passionate alternative. So when he says, I don't want you to be unaware, brethren, he's really saying, listen up. I got something important to tell you. And he starts off, I don't want you to be unaware that our fathers, notice, with this, he's combining all the people of God. Okay. The fathers would be, if he's talking about, we can see, he's referring to, obviously, the Jewish fathers, but now he's equating them to the Christian fathers also. So the application that he's going to make of the Jews is equally applicable to Christians. Okay. And he's going to bring that up several times in various ways. He says, I don't want you to be unaware that our fathers were all under the cloud, and that's significant. I mean, there's people that are going to say, you know, as he gets into the description of baptism, well, they weren't really baptized. Although he's making an equivalent of it. Because they say, well, the waters were divided and they went through on dry land and they really weren't submerged. Well, yeah, if you put the cloud over it, yeah, they were. Okay, they were under the cloud, you know, and through the sea. In fact, if you look at is it Exodus 14 where it talks about it, or Exodus 13, they were in the midst of the sea. That's the terminology that's used. So Paul's very accurate, said this is a form of baptism. They were all baptized into Moses. Okay, just as we're baptized into Christ. Okay, so he's making a parallel here. They were brought out of bondage, we're brought out of bondage too. Okay, they passed through the things they needed to, this baptism, okay, into Moses, and we're, you know, the same way into Christ. He says even more, they all ate of the same spiritual food and drank of the same spiritual drink. Now, often, you know, people want to equate this with just the physical, the manna from heaven and the quail. But notice the word spiritual. Okay, he's got a it's kind of a reference, but it's just the same kind of reference that Jesus makes in John 6, around verse 35, when he says, okay, he's talking about the manna that God gave to the Israelites, but he's saying, I'm the bread from heaven. And there's this spiritual aspect to it. In fact, if you look at Psalm 78, when it refers to it, the Masoretic text actually calls it corn or grain from heaven, and the Septuagint calls it the bread of angels. So it has a little higher significance to it. But here he goes, you know, it was spiritual food, it was spiritual drink, because they all drank from the spiritual rock which followed them. Now there's cases where, you know, a rock was called upon to give water to the Israelites on two occasions. But there wasn't something that followed them in the wilderness. Now, the Jews have a myth about the little stone that kind of followed the Israelites around through the wilderness. Yeah, myth, okay. This rock he calls a Petra, a, you know, big rock ledge. It's the same kind of difference he makes between in Matthew 16, 18. Okay, yes, thou art Peter, Petros, small stone, but upon this rock, this big ledge, I will build my church. Okay, this rock, this huge escarpment, follow them through the wilderness. If you got any kind of question what he's talking about, this rock was Christ. So Paul is saying here, you know, the blessings they had began really with Christ. It was he in the burning bush. This is what he says in John 8. You know, I am, you know, the one that was in the burning bush. And so Christ was with them. You know, he was there, you know, the giving of the Mosaic law. Okay, they were fed this spiritual encouragement by God all the way through their journeys in the wilderness. Okay, God looked after them. Okay, reiterating, as they made their journeys, they were protected from their enemies. Their clothes didn't wear out. Okay, they were fed every day with, you know, with food, you know, with something to drink. Okay, but in the midst of all of that, they still had a problem. Okay. So, number, you know, 5, is that where we are now? Okay. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased. That litotes again. You know, a light negative implying, you know, basically saying God was really mad at them, angry. And so they laid low in the wilderness, literally scattered. Almost think of their bones. He scattered their bones throughout the wilderness over 40 years. He says, this is an example to them, or example to us, that we should not crave evil things as they also crave them. Okay, so Corinthians had a problem, but it's the same problem that we have. In fact, Paul's going to make that equation a little bit later in verse 13. But he goes, you know, let us not then be idolaters, as some of them were. Yeah, as it is written, you know, they sat down to eat and drink and they rose up to play. Okay, this is from Exodus 32, in the worship of the golden calf. Now, what's interesting is that their worship of the golden calf was really a worship to Jehovah. Okay, Moses was up on the mountain, okay, and they got tired of waiting for him. And you know, they knew the God that they needed to serve, but notice, they did it their way. Okay? They did it with the familiarity they had of the religions that they left. They wanted to make it entertaining for them. So they needed something physical they could see, some sort of image. And they wanted to sit down and eat and drink. They made a party of it because that appealed to them. As far as they were concerned, they're still worshiping God, but they were still doing it their way, the way they used to in pagan Egypt. Sat down to eat and drink, and then they stood up and played, you know, danced, whatever you had, because that was entertaining. Does it strike a bell now of how people are distorting worship services, changing every aspect of it, you know, to fit what they want to do to feel religious? Let us not also be fornicators, as some of them did. Now, this really equated to the Corinthians because they were doing exactly what Israel did. The incident is from Numbers 26. And it was where the people in the wilderness, as they were worshiping God, they began to bring the daughters of Moab into the assembly. And as at Corinth, the women became part of the worship service. Okay? Fornicating. Okay? They begin to mix their carnality with supposedly their holy worship. And at one point, God had them, you know, put to the sword. And then after it's all over, this one guy comes in and he's bringing, you know, one of these women with him. He doesn't realize what's going on. And it so upsets Phinehas that he picks up a spear, follows the guy in a tent, and you can realize what they're doing because he sticks the spear in and pierces both of them together. That's the way the guy was worshiping God. Okay. In this instance, the very last verse says that there fell that day 24,000 Israelites. These are the people of God committing fornication. What Paul says is, what you don't realize is 23,000 of them fell in one day. That's a lot of people to die for their sins. And do not be, he goes on to say, as some of them did, and try the Lord. There was an occasion when the king of Arad had decided to go to war against the Israelites. This is in Numbers 21, the beginning of the chapter. And God said, okay, in fact, they appealed to God to be with them. And God said, okay, I'll be with you, whatever. And so he led them around from Horeb, around Edom, and then got tired of the journey. I mean, they wanted God to be with them, but they wanted to do it their way. They didn't want to take a roundabout route. And on the way, they started to try God. I mean, he wasn't doing things, you know, the way they wanted to. I mean, basically it says, I think in verse 6, it said, yeah, you're not giving us any food. Was that really a complaint? Because in the same verse it goes, and you know, what, you know, the food you're giving us is loathsome. Well, wait a minute. I thought you said he's not giving you any food. Well, he is. He's just not giving them to the degree and the kind and, you know, whatever that they want. And so they're trying God. You know, if he doesn't do it their way, they're looking at it as a test. They're looking at it as a test of God. If he doesn't do it the way they want him to do it, then he really doesn't exist. But he does exist. He sent serpents among them. And that had to be stopped. In fact, we still have, you know, the sign of the medical profession. The stick and the two serpents on it, because that's what Moses had reared up, so anybody who looked on it and didn't die of the snake bites. And he also says, and this is probably where it gets more close to home, not to grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Okay, two incidences of this. One is in Numbers 14. In fact, you've got 14 and 16 you could probably look at as the grumbling chapters. Where, first of all, there's a rebellion by Korah and his family. And he chooses off Moses and Aaron for leadership of the tribes. And as he stands before Moses, God opens up the earth and swallows him. Closes it back up. And then after that, the people began to complain, well, Moses is the one that brought it on that our fellow people died. Now, they're going to lay it on, not on their sin, but on Moses, God's servant. Grumbling. Now, grumbling at its core is unbelief. I mean, when you grumble against God, you really don't think he exists or that he hears. I mean, that's the core of it. In that incident, 14,700 died. Also, as part of this, in Numbers 16, after the spies were sent out, and Joshua and Caleb comes back, and they go, hey, it really is a land full of milk and honey. You know, we can take it. It's got, you know, great cities in it. Everything's waiting for us. As God promised, cities they wouldn't build, vineyards they wouldn't plant, cisterns they wouldn't dig. It's all there. A whole society already architecturally set up for them. And with God behind them, all they had to do was go in and take it. And the 10 tribes, or the 10 spies came back and said, no, there's giants there, we can't take it, whatever. Lack of faith in God. And the people believed the 10. And God was so mad at them, and they're grumbling about all this, oh, he's let us out here to die and everything else. God put a curse on the whole group of people. Basically said, not one of you are going to leave this desert except for Joshua and Caleb. We said the numbers before. 600,000 men left Egyptian bondage. 2 made it to Canaan. But this time, Christians and Jews should have been start thinking about, you know, God's pretty serious about this. This is what Paul's trying to tell them. As you're, you know, living out your Christianity and your service to God, what are you trying to do? Are you just aimlessly walking around, beating the air? Are you running around in circles? Or are you sitting down and thinking about it? How can you improve yourself? How you can improve your relationship with God? Of really beginning to serve him devotedly as his children. And then Paul addresses it again. These things were types, examples for us. Because we're doing the same thing. They're a type of us being an antitype. Of doing the same thing. Our idolatry, our fornication, our trying the Lord, our grumbling. Complaining all the time about what's going on. It says it's written for our instruction. Now, notice, when Paul inserts the word our, he's including himself, which he already did in the last part of chapter 9. He says, even apostles aren't exempt for this. So we really have to be careful. Especially upon, this is our last chance. You know, it's become on the end of the ages. Okay, no more dispensations. No more covenants. Okay? God is going to, as type, respond to us exactly the way he responded to them. No partiality. Okay? Therefore, the warning. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he falls. Okay. Reword it. Put it as a question. How solid a Christian do you think you are? You really think you're doing everything you should be doing? How's your devotion? How's your prayer life? How is your obedience to God's commands going? This is what Paul's asking. We looked at Philippians last time, 2:12, where Paul says, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. You think he was kidding? Now, a little bit of saving grace. Last verse, 13. No temptation has overcome us, has overtaken man, but is not common to all. Now, it's an interesting wording in the original. It says, there's no temptation that is not human. That's what the Greek literally says. Meaning, you know, just as the translation, you know, puts it there. We are not extra special or different than the Jewish people in the wilderness. We're the same kind of people. We haven't changed. We still have to make right decisions. And the odds are kind of the same, too. You know, we've already looked at Matthew, 13th chapter, you know, that broad, you know, wide gate, broad way that many enter into. That's what the odds are. They're given here in this, in the context. Because the world is very serious about pulling us down. And if we don't get serious about our devotion to God, we're going to lose ourselves. We're going to be scattered among the other Israelites in the wilderness, in our own wilderness. But God is faithful, that will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you can endure. Okay, each person is different. Each person's got their own demons. But God is with each one of us. He provides, it says, a way of escape. But we still have the obligation to look for it. Judas and Peter were two apostles with problems. Okay, remember what Jesus said to Peter. You know, get behind me, Satan. There was a time where Satan had a hold of Peter. Jesus, you know, if you remember John 16, sat down with Peter and provided a way of escape, a way of helping. I mean, Peter was devastated that he, you know, wasn't as strong as he thought he was, that he did deny his Lord. And Jesus helped him back. And he found the way of escape. In fact, we'll cover the rest of this verse in a second. Judas was also provided with ways of escape. At the Lord's Supper, constantly, Jesus provided a way for Judas to forget the whole thing and start doing the right thing. Unfortunately, Judas waited too long to wake up. And still, he could have, you know, he walked with his Lord. He knew the forgiveness that could have been there. He didn't have to hang himself. Christ would have forgiven him. But he didn't take it. Two choices. Not only will God provide a way of escape, but he's make it possible that we'll endure the problem. Okay. Again, I love that word endure. To be able to take something that's against you and use it for your benefit. This is Christ enduring the cross. It was supposed to be the ultimate victory for his enemies. He used it as the ultimate victory for his friends. So whatever problems we have in this world, if we start waking up and start looking for what God has provided for us, we can use it not only to help ourselves, but use it for God's benefit in helping others. Think of the Alcoholics Anonymous or any kind of addiction seminars. Some of the best teachers are the people that have come out of the addiction. They know what you're going through. And they're used as the best aids to help other people recover. We can do that too. Understanding the sins that we have to pass through and overcoming them, looking at the victory that God has given us, we can apply it to help others. And we need to apply it to help others. Okay, we're about to sing number 191. We're not as packed as we were this morning because none of the visitors are here. Okay. So I can't give that invitation. But there's still an invitation here, in fact, a very strong one to anybody in the audience. If you're not a Christian, you realize how you enter into it. The Jews entered into it through an immersion of the cloud and the sea and into a life, hopefully, devoted as Joshua and Caleb were. Sometime do a study on those two characters. Okay. We know Moses had his faults. I mean, but he's looked up as one of the great leaders of the Bible. But Moses had, first of all, he didn't want to go through this whole thing to begin with. I mean, he had his own complaints. Oh, I'm not, I've got a speech impediment, whatever. They're not going to listen to me. Okay, Aaron will be your mouth. Okay, so we fix that. Yeah, but they're still not going to listen. Okay, throw down your rod. I mean, God's got to work with Moses. Even as, he's trying to get the Israelites out, he's facing a lot of problems. He gets confronted by, are you going to kill me as you did that Egyptian? And now he goes off and pouts for 40 years before he comes back again. Okay, even as he gets them all out and starts, God's about to kill him. I mean, there's a little incident in there where he's slowly dying. We don't really know why. And we have to make a deduction because suddenly his wife gets up and goes and circumcises the child, and then Moses gets better. Evidently, he refused to do that. And God was killing him for it, for his disobedience. Moses was almost, if it wasn't for his wife's action, not going to lead these people even into, Mount Sinai. And then there was, when he didn't give God the credit and smote the rock instead of just speaking to it. Moses didn't make it into Canaan. Now, we have no doubts, even with all his faults, he made it into heaven. But of those that started out, look up the ones that made it, Joshua and Caleb. Interestingly, like Daniel, there's nothing bad said about him. I mean, Joshua is a rock through all this stuff. He is a natural-born leader. Not bad for a guy that starts out as a secretary. But he steps up for the responsibility, and he meets the challenge. And Caleb, as they're going in and conquering the land, Caleb is an exemplary warrior and also a leader of his tribe. And we need to also be able to do that. We need to be somebody that God can depend on. We need to grow to be a proper tool for him, serving God to the best of our ability. Now, if you haven't been baptized yet, we can offer you that ability, that step to take this very hour. We actually have water in the baptistry. Okay, you can have your sins washed away and begin a life of service to God. If you don't do that, you're still in your sins, and you're not right with God. That's God's application of things. That's the way he wants it done. And it's interesting. It's a very simple act, but how many denominations just refuse to do it or claim it's just not necessary until you get around to it? For the rest of us, this lesson is for us to make sure that we are standing, that we do need help from one another. We need to be as hard and strong for God as possible. And this is why he gave us the church, to be there for one another. If there's anything we can do, any prayers, classes, or whatever, please let us know as we stand to sing.